Today's Tay Show will be on Case 95 in the Hikigan Roku, the P-Yen Loop. The Hikigan Roku, Case 95, is entitled Chokei and Hofuku, Discuss the Buddha's Words. Engo's introduction, do not remain where the Buddha is. If you do, horns will grow on your head. Run quickly past the place where there is no Buddha. If not, weeds will grow like a jungle. Even if you are entirely naked and absolutely bare, and the unhindered interpenetration of mind and circumstances is attained, you still cannot avoid resembling the fool who watched the tree stump to catch a hare. Now tell me, what are you to do in order to be free from these faults? See the following. Main subject. Chokei one day said, even if you say that the arhats still have the three poisons, you should not say that the Tathagata has two languages. I do not say that the Tathagata has no language, but that he does not have two languages. Hofuku said, what is the Tathagata's language? Chokei said, how can a deaf person hear it? Hofuku said, I know you are speaking from a secondary principle. Chokei said, what is the Tathagata's language? Hofuku said, have a cup of tea. Secho's verse, who speaks from the first? Who speaks from the second principle? Dragons do not lie in puddles. Where dragons lurk, waves arise when no wind blows. Oh, you Ryozen monk, you've bruised your head on the dragon gate. So I want to thank everybody for coming here to practice Zen this morning. We've been having a deep sitting. I'm happy to report really deep sitting this morning in our virtual Zendo. Everybody's really still in samadhi, deep samadhi. That's wonderful to see. Thank you for making such an excellent effort. And it's wonderful to see a number of people who haven't been here for a while. It's really great to see a number of you. I'm so glad you could make it, so glad you could be here. So this koan makes no sense at all, which is a good thing. That will be more and more apparent as I go on with the koan. But I just want to say a little bit about the first part. It says, even if you are entirely naked and absolutely bare and the unhindered interpenetration of mind and circumstances is attained, you still cannot avoid resembling the fool who watched the tree stump to catch a hare. So the first part is, even if you have no obstacle between you and the unfolding of circumstances, that there still may be a problem. And in that case, you will be like the fool. In Chinese culture, there's a joke about a person who had a brilliant idea. He was hungry, and he had this idea that he was going to hide in front of a tree stump and wait for a rabbit to come running by and hit the tree stump, knock itself out, and then he would cook and eat it, right? In other words, something that never happens, right? Never happens. So somebody who's counting on something that will never happen, basically, that's the illusion. So you'll be like the guy who cleverly waited for a rabbit to run into a tree and knock itself unconscious. Okay. So, I was, first of all, I'm so glad you came here instead of sitting glued to the television, watching the pre-election results, right? And the truth is, you know, you can spend all Tuesday watching the election results, but there's no sense watching the pre-election results, right? It's great to set that aside. You know, it's crucially important that this outcome, this election, have the right outcome. But whether it has the right outcome or not, in a certain way, that won't change anything. And that may seem like a shocking statement. But, you know, every day we have to get up and do our work. And if you follow the Great Way, your work is to purify body, mind, and heart. Or as the sutras say, purify body, mind, and speech, actually. Body, mind, and speech. And we do that by going into deep samadhi and working through our obstacles. And when we go into deep samadhi and we work through our obstacles, we experience the world in a fundamentally different way, or we can experience the world in a fundamentally different way. And it's absolutely the case that there are many things to be anxious about. But if you cultivate the Great Way, you know, everything becomes an opportunity to wake up. Everything becomes an opportunity to wake up. Even this election, no matter what the outcome, becomes an opportunity to wake up. So more on this in a while, but I was listening to something on NPR the other night. I was driving back from the sit on, I guess it was last night. And there's a show that I enjoy listening to called On the Media. I don't know if you've ever listened to On the Media, but I think it's one of the savviest programs on the media. And it talks about newspaper stories, you know, the electronic media, television, movies, and the hosts are really fascinating, I think, in their understanding of how media works and so on. But they had this wonderful woman on at the end of the program, and she has done some fascinating work. Her name is Lulu Miller, and she has a book called There Is No Such Thing as Fish. And I haven't bought the book, and I haven't read it, and I'm not necessarily ready to recommend it and say, go out and get that book. But everything I've heard from the interview is really resonates with me as somebody who practices Zen and follows Buddhism. And she's a journalist, and she covers the sciences. And she was studying this man named David Starr Jordan. And David Starr Jordan was a biologist, and he was studying fish in California, in San Francisco. And he had spent many years acquiring specimens that he would examine. And all the specimens were in jars. He had gone out on boats day after day and collected all these specimens. And for his time, which was earlier in the 20th century, and the late 19th century, he was really radical, because his teacher was a man named Louis Agassiz. I don't know if you've ever heard of Louis Agassiz, but Louis Agassiz was one of the pioneering biologists of the 19th century. And he was very interested in looking at the way animals are structured. So, you know, he would look at the down to fine observation of like the way scales are organized on a fish, and the way the tail is articulated and the fins are articulated. And this was all part of Agassiz's attempt to classify species according to their physical characteristics, right? So Agassiz pushed biology very far in terms of classifying different species, classification, and scientific classification. So, you know, is a bass related to a bluegill or not, and a trout, right? And what you would do is look at the structures of the bass, the structures of the bluegill, the structures of the trout, and you decide whether they were related or not based on their structures. Now, the interesting thing was, you know, Agassiz believed that Agassiz was a very devout religious believer, Christian. And he believed that God created all the species that existed and that they hadn't changed at all. He didn't know actually how old the earth was. People didn't know that at that time. They didn't know the universe is 14 billion years old and so on. So he actually assumed that all the species had not changed. But David Starr Jordan was like a revolutionary biologist. And he was collecting fish in the San Francisco Bay Area and putting them in these jars and studying them. And he was a Darwinian. And he said, wait a minute. You know, species change over time. So, you know, basically his idea was to classify these fish using Darwinian principles, you know. And he was a determined person of enormous determination. So he had spent years and years collecting this library of fish specimens, right? And then the San Francisco earthquake hit, and you can imagine what the San Francisco earthquake did with all of his fish specimens in jars, right? The whole building that he had them in fell down. They were all destroyed, and he started again. You know, he just got up the next day and he got on his boat and he sailed out into the San Francisco Bay and started collecting fish again. And she said, you know, she got interested in this guy because he was, you know, a pioneering scientist. He was willing to challenge the orthodoxies of his day. And he believed in this idea of evolution, creating different species. And also, he was not somebody daunted by something like an earthquake. So she began to study him, and she said she admired him enormously. Admired him enormously. Here's a guy who's asking questions about life, looking carefully, meticulously at different species. And he made all these pioneering discoveries in biology. And won all these honors and these awards early in the early 20th century. And she said, but then she began to notice something else about him, that he was deeply involved in scientific racism and eugenics. His name is David Starr Jordan. And he just as he classified fish, you know, these fish have these characteristics and they're here, and these fish have these characteristics and they're over there. He started to classify humans, right? And, you know, he was a white man at the end of the 19th century. You can imagine where the white men went in that system, right? So he began to apply the science he had applied to the study of fish to the study of humans. And he began to assume that just as some fish are more evolved than other fish, right, some humans are more evolved than other humans. And she began to have a very different view of this man she had admired so much at the beginning of her research. Because not only was he an advocate of scientific racism, but he got involved in eugenics. So he was very involved in the attempt to control human breeding populations, sterilize people who have so-called defects. And she said he did terrible things in his life. And so she began to really ask herself where this guy had gone wrong. You know, how is it possible for somebody so intelligent and observant to go so terribly wrong? And, you know, he has his own personal stories. He's a very flawed human being, right? But you know, she decided that it really wasn't about David Starr Jordan as a person, but about the way he understood the world, You know, his desire was to understand everything in terms of a perfect system or perfect order. And, you know, he believed that he was like uncovering the order of the natural world, And so, you know, he did these incredibly detailed studies of fish. And he said, you know, this fish is related to this fish, is related to this fish. And over here, this fish is related to this fish, and then, and so on. And he had, you know, these fish are primitive fish. These are more advanced fish. These are the most advanced fish. And it makes sense in a way, in a strange way, that he would apply that not only to fish, but to other animals, you know, mammals or terrestrial mammals, and finally to us, because we're a terrestrial mammal. And his racism was really like scientific racism. It was based on scientific principles as she has understood them. So the interesting thing about her own involvement in this is that she began to study how contemporary scientists look at evolution. And she says they've completely rejected many of his findings. There's something that I don't know much about that she's trained in what's called cladistics. And she says that's a study of biological structures that works in a very different way from Agassiz's way of studying or David Starr Jordan's way of studying. You know, they look at, instead of assuming that, well, here's an example that she gave that I thought was so fascinating. She said, you have something called a lungfish. Some of you have heard about, maybe you've heard about lungfish. She said, if you put a lungfish in front of your students, and you put a trout in front of your students, and you put a cow in front of your students, and you say, which of these two species is closer to each other? You know, because all of our biology comes from people like David Starr Jordan, we'll say, oh, the lungfish and the trout are closest to each other. And she says, but actually that's not true. She says, she would like her students to see that actually the lungfish and the cow are closer to each other than the lungfish and the trout. This seems to be like crazy, right? But she said, if you look at the lungfish has lungs, not gills, it has lungs. And she said, it even has an epiglottis. Like, we have an epiglottis. In some languages, there's something called a glottal stop. It's like ein, right? That's using our epiglottis. It's a little flap that closes over our throat to protect keep food from falling in there. And we can use it for speech. And she said, actually, a lungfish has an epiglottis. So she said, so when scientists today look at evolution, they have a completely different viewpoint about how things evolved. And she said, we think it stands to reason that all fish are fish and all fowl are fowl and all hoofed mammals are hoofed mammals. She said, but biologists don't think that way anymore. It's not neatly organized like that. She said, there's there's huge diversity among fish, and what we call fish are not in many ways the same at all. That's why the title of her book is There's No Such Thing as a Fish. The person who was interviewing her is familiar with cladistics and said, yes, these scientists make all these claims now based on cladistics, and they're totally convinced that this is correct science. But she said, it can't. People in our world, like people like me and you, have a very hard time believing that a lungfish and a trout aren't closer to each other than a lungfish and a cow, right? Because the cows live on land and lungfish live in the water. But she said, actually, that's our common sense kicking in, and it can't be trusted. And it's our language kicking in, right? So, you know, in Genesis, it says, you know, he made the beast, the fish, and he made the birds of the air, and he made animals that walketh upon the earth, right? So it's like, of course, that makes perfect sense. But that's not how evolution actually works, she said. And it's still hard for me to get my mind around it. But the interviewer who knows cladistics said, all this science says this is true, but people can't get their minds around it, right? And what this woman said, Lulu Miller said, was so interesting. She said, you know, we have this powerful drive to make sense of everything, to create order out of what we call chaos, right? Order out of chaos. Let's see if I can find what she said, because I thought it was so great. She said, I mean, even as a journalist, she's a science journalist, as someone trying to make sense of just the utter chaos and confusion all around us, I think sometimes that lust, that craving for order, for a coherent story, for meaning, on the one hand, is the most natural thing in the world, because otherwise we're just overwhelmed and bulldozed by all the confusion. But on the other side, the desire to see a story or see order can be really dangerous, right? Because she said, you take all these shortcuts and you leave things out that completely bias the story you tell. And she said, actually, that's what David Starr Jordan did. You know, he had an idea of order. And he made the natural world fit it, right? He made it fit. Everything could be made to fit. And he made it to fit by keeping out everything that didn't fit his system. And the thing is, he didn't know he was keeping it out, right? He thought he trusted his common sense. He even trusted his training. And what Lulu Miller says is, you know, actually, it's incredibly hard not to do this. But we have to realize that what we call order I agree with her. But she said, what we call order is a kind of violence we do to the world. It's a kind of violence. Now, I thought that was, when I heard those words on the radio, I was really blown away. You know, because I actually think she's got a point, you know, that, you know, we can't help but create a little system in our minds as individuals and as species, as a culture. And, you know, it seems self-evidently true. It seems absolutely clearly so. And the assumptions we bring to our experience shape our experience, right? Shape our experience and color our experience in ways that sort of prevent us from seeing what doesn't fit. And so when we put everything in its proper place, right? Everything in its proper place, we're actually engaged in like a kind of violence. We're actually excluding what we most need to see. And we all do this, you know. I had this experience long ago. I myself am a gardener. I love to garden. It's incredibly relaxing and wonderful to just sit and garden for the day. You know, I can't always do it because I don't always have time. But, you know, I'm also a big fan of gardens, Chinese gardens and Japanese gardens and English gardens. I love them all. And, you know, when I travel, I always try to go to like an arboretum or a garden and look at it, just spend the day just taking it in. And I'll never forget, you know, when I was in the Seattle Zen Center training, we used to go up to the Japanese garden and spend time in the tea house. My second teacher, Webb Roshi, was a master of sado, of tea ceremony. And sometimes we'd have tea ceremonies up there. But I went up one day by myself, and, and nobody was there. And, you know, if you, nobody was there except the maintenance people. And if you go to the Japanese garden in Seattle on a Saturday, it looks like the very embodiment of beautiful nature, of nature's order, you could say. You know, there's a tea house set in these red pines, and the asymmetry is perfect. There's a pond. There's Japanese irises around the pond. There's, Japanese maples and rhododendrons. And one day I went there and nobody was there and the crew was there. And they were like spraying Roundup all over everything. It was like, oh my God, they were pulling out any native plant. You know, there were like these native maples. They were pulling them all out. They were spraying Roundup. The pond itself had a plastic liner, as it turns out, you know. So, you know, actually this scene that looks so beautiful and so natural and so natural and unspoiled, so orderly, was totally imaginary. It wasn't orderly at all. It wasn't natural at all. It was an invention, see. And I didn't stop loving Japanese gardens, but it made me realize, you know, that we impose on our experience all of these assumptions. And, you know, we really can't necessarily trust our intuition, actually, you know. Because our intuition is saturated with with assumptions that just aren't true. So, you know, one of the things that Lulu Miller said was that, you know, she's studied fish. And I myself have koi, you know, I've talked about koi. And for many years I had a koi named Phineas, who I was a love affair between man and fish, if I may say so, you know. And Phineas would eat out of my hand, right? Out of my hand. And she said fish are incredibly intelligent creatures. You know, they have all of these complex social behaviors. They have astonishing memory. They can travel from like, you know, the Arctic down to the tropics and back, you know. And she said they've done all these studies about how fish cope with stress. And she said when fish are stressed, they like to be held. You know, she said they all crowd together and touch each other. And she said, and doesn't that sound familiar? You know, they like a hug. You know, fish like a hug. So she said, you know, all of our assumptions about, you know, humans are here, you know, dogs are, you know, humans are here, you know, dolphins are here, chimps are here. She said, all of this is a fantasy, you know. And when we say, oh, they're just fish, you know, we're doing incredible violence to these sentient beings. So, you know, as I was driving home and listening to this about the fish, of course, I myself love my fish, you know, and I'm totally convinced they're intelligent. when I come home, they get very excited. They zip around the pond. I can feed them out of my hand, my koi out of my hand. They live for 50 years, you know, actually. They have memories. They remember, you know, where to go in the pond, where I'm going to be. They're there before I'm there, waiting for me to get there. You know, they're sentient beings, right? And we kind of can discover that by accident, but all of these assumptions that we bring to our experience of, say, they're just fish, right, get in our way. You may know that a commonplace Buddhist practice in East Asia is to go to the market and buy birds and fish that are slated for the dinner table and to set them free. So it's quite common in, say, Chinese temples to have a little pond where people release the fish, they release imprisoned fish, right, and let them go free again, right? I think that's a good impulse. But, you know, on a deeper level, how do we not do this? How do we not impose on everything around us the violence that comes from our craving for order? How do we live with chaos? Because you know what? What we call chaos is nature's order. In fact, there is no such thing as chaos, and there is no such thing as order, according to Lulu Miller and according to Buddhist teachings. You know, so basically, one things move among and intermingle, right? Things are just constantly in a state of interdependent changefulness. And we want them to stop, and we want them to be a certain way, but they never are and never will be and never can be if existence is to continue, right? So, you know, how do we live in this quote-unquote chaos, right, without the violence that comes from trying to impose order on it? And I think, myself, that Buddhism is all about exactly this, right? It's all about exactly this. You know, when I said this morning, you know, we've come to Sesshin to purify body, mind, and heart. What does it mean to purify body, mind, and heart? It means to dissolve our expectations, to dissolve our preconditions, our presuppositions. You know, in classical Buddhist philosophy, those are called seeds, right? They're, or habit energies. You know, if every day at 5 o'clock on my way home from work, I stop at Baskin Robbins or, you know, whatever, at Carvel Ice Cream, since this is New Jersey, I don't even know if there are any Carvel ice cream stores left. And I have an ice cream cone, you know, maybe I'll get a Rocky Road. And then one day I go into the ice cream store and I say, I'll have a Rocky Road. And he goes, we're out. Suddenly it's like fury, right? Fury, what? That's an energy habit, right? But, you know, we have layered energy habit on energy habit. Energy habits are like the residue of the way we've adapted to circumstances, right? So, you know, if I have a lot of stress at work, I might decide to have a drink at the end of the day. And then at the end of every day, even before I have the drink, I'm craving the drink, see? Or, you know, if I'm having trouble at home, rather than go home and have an argument with my spouse, I might decide to just work another hour. And by then, you know, she'll be watching TV, right? So I won't have to have a conversation with her. That's an energy habit, right? So, you know, actually, energy habits are like ways we've been able to control the quote-unquote chaos. And we keep repeating those behaviors. And actually what they do is they make us more and more rigid, more and more rigid-minded, more and more removed from things. So in Zen practice, we practice wuxing, right? Emptiness. We sit down on the cushion and we go into wuxing. And even though that seems like just a passive practice of emptying the mind, it's actually extremely active practice of dissolving our energy habits, our habit energies, right? And gradually allowing us to respond to the world in a way that's more fluid, less fearful and rigid, right? And when we respond that way, you know, everything comes to life. That when we stop trying to impose order, either like the order of our culture or the order of our own personal culture, right? You know, the amazing thing is that the world becomes alive in a way that it's not normally alive when we're just trying to match the reality with our expectations. You know, in the middle of the summer, I was looking for a particular wild plant that grows here in New Jersey. And I wanted it for my garden, right? So I couldn't get it at the plant store. I went to different plant stores and I said, do you have this plant? Nobody had it. So I remember that it grows wild sometimes in like abandoned lots. So if you know the area around Lucy Stone Hall, there's actually like a parking lot, and behind the parking lot, there's like this area that's sort of abandoned. You know, there's weeds growing up and everything. And I went over there and I was poking around trying to find these plants. And I didn't find them, but I found so much interest, so much actually amazing plant life, right? And it was really beautiful. The place is a jumble. You know, there's broken pieces of macadam, there's pieces of cement that they've just dumped in a pile. And but actually there's all this life, right? And as I was coming out, I was a little disappointed. I had a pot and a little shovel and I was hoping to find this plant. I looked and what should confront me but a giant hawk, right? And in front of the hawk was a rabbit. And I froze because, you know, I don't know who was going to win, the rabbit or the hawk, right? And the rabbit ran and the hawk went after him. And actually the hawk didn't get the rabbit, you know. And it was thrilling to see, right? And at all in a, we would just say this is like an abandoned lot. And the drama going on in an abandoned lot. Maybe I was prepared for it. You know, if I had just been coming out of work and went back there looking for the plant, I might not have had the same experience of like, everything here is so alive. You know, there's all these wild morning glories growing over this abandoned macadam, you know, and all these the rabbits. And so, you know, in order to live, we create these habit energies, you know, and they're helpful, right? They're like having a little system for dealing with the world. But you know, the more we repeat our little systems, the less we see. And so, you know, this is a basic principle of Buddhism, right? So you know, what we have to do is unteach ourselves or unlearn the way we've come to see things in order to make them manageable and safe and so Zen is about, you could say, unlearning and learning to live with chaos, and when you do that, everything comes to life and you can respond in fresh, creative ways. And in ways that make you realize that, you know, in Buddhism, we say, you know, actually, from the Buddhist standpoint, everything is absolutely equal to everything else. That's a basic principle of Mahayana Buddhism, the absolute equality of all things. And, you know, I've tried to explain that to people and they say, oh, you mean to tell me a bird, you know, a sparrow is as important as a human being, you know? And what does that mean, important, right? You know, if we don't have any birds, we're not going to have any humans, you know? If we don't have any bees, we're not going to have any humans. You know, when you think a certain way, you can make this hierarchy, but, you know, actually, all things are equally important. All things are equally necessary. You know, this is what it means to live with chaos, right? To live with chaos. Every moment is absolutely the most important moment. Everything alive is absolutely equal to every other thing that's alive. You know, you might have seen the Potala Palace in Lhasa, the Dalai Lama's palace. When they built that, the people who built that actually screened the soil so that when they made the adobe blocks, they wouldn't put any living beings in the mud, right? So they pulled the worms out and the bugs so they wouldn't kill them. It's like letting the fish go, you know, and taking them to the pond at the temple, or buying birds at the bird market and setting them free. So we humans speak two languages, right? We speak two languages. But the Tathagata, the Buddha, speaks one language. We speak artificial language. But there's another language, right, which doesn't use words. And that's the language the Buddha speaks, and it's the language we're learning here at Sesshin, here in Zen practice. Engo's introduction, do not remain where the Buddha is. That's an idea. If you do, horns will grow on your head. Run quickly past the place where there is no Buddha, where the Buddha isn't. If not, weeds will grow like a jungle. Even if you are entirely naked and absolutely bare, the unhindered interpenetration of mind and circumstances, even if that, the unhindered penetration of mind and circumstances is attained, you still cannot avoid resembling the fool who watched the tree stump to catch a rabbit. In other words, you know, as soon as we have a new experience, a fresh experience, we freeze it in our minds and make it rigid again. We turn it into a habit energy. And so the way to be open is constantly to dissolve, constantly to take apart our mental structures in order to rebuild them in response to changing circumstances. Now tell me, what are you to do in order to be free from these faults? See the following. Choke one day said, even if you say that the arhats still have the three poisons, greed, anger, and delusion, you should not say that the Tathagata has two languages. I do not say that the Tathagata has no language, but that he does not have two languages. Hofuku said, what is the Tathagata's language? Choke said, how can a deaf person hear it? Hofuku said, in other words, you're deaf, right? Hofuku said, I know that you are speaking from a secondary principle. In other words, you're not speaking from the place beyond your mental constructions. Choke said, what is the Tathagata's language? Hofuku said, have a cup of tea. Erase your obstacles, erase your barriers, dissolve your energy habits, and be in the moment. So that's the great way of the ancestors. Setro's verse, who speaks from the first, who speaks from the second principle? Dragon, you're a dragon. It says, you're a dragon, you're a dragon. Don't lie in a puddle, right? Don't trust energy habits, you're a dragon. Cultivate emptiness. Where dragons lurk, waves arise when no wind blows. Anything can happen if you clean up your energy habits. Oh, you Ryo Zen monk, you've bruised your head on the dragon gate. So, let's become the dragons we are. Okay? And by practicing this beautiful path of emptiness.